Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, November 24th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. You're broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. The program today, historian Christopher Shaw, author of First Class, The U.S. Postal Service, Democracy, and the Corporate Threat. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Emma Vigeland and I are here, but only...
Are we really here?
Only through the use of a time machine.
Oh.
I'm not going to say when, but prior to this moment, we traveled into this time. Did this intro, and then traveled back to this time in a different place.
Yes. We won't tell you when, but we will say that Candace Owens is president.
That's right. Where we are in the future, Candace Owens is president, and I've got some very bad news for everybody about what's going on. No, folks, it's one of our famous post office on the day before Thanksgiving shows that we have started this tradition this year, and already people are already talking about it, like Emma and me.
Yes.
This is a new interview, ladies.
And we know that because we're coming from the future.
So that's right.
We know how.
Believe me, it's crazy how this has gone viral, this show.
Believe me.
Postal Wednesday is bigger than Black Friday now.
Huge. It is Postal Wednesday. I talked to historian Christopher Shaw about the post office, about his perspective on the postal banking experiment or pilot program that's going on Louis DeJoy, but also the history of the post office and the functioning of the post office. Look, the post office, the U.S. post office is, you know, damn near a miracle. I mean, it's teleportation. It's just a little bit slow. Right? Like, oh my God, I have this letter here.
Yeah.
And I want to send it to somebody. And then all I got to do is put it in that blue box over there on the corner of the street, or just put it in my mail slot. And then bingo bango, in a couple of days, they have it.
You're right. It is like teleportation.
It's just a little slower.
Right. And you can't transmit human bodies, which would be, I mean, that's mostly what the usage of teleportation is in most science fiction.
Well, as someone who wears glasses, and Matt and I do not appreciate that.
I wear glasses on occasion.
Yeah,
I should be wearing them more often than I do. Yeah.
I find when I actually wear my contact lenses, I'd still do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Very Chuck Schumer of you.
Yeah, he does that?
I mean, I guess he just leaves them on his nose, on the bridge of his nose. Yeah, maybe the opposite. I got that wrong.
Hey, folks, just want to remind you that one of our top sponsors of this program, SunsetLakeSabade.com. I put my sign away. Where the hell? Oh, here it is. I got it right here. They've got a special Black Friday fundraiser deal going on. Okay, so it's usually SunsetLakeSabade.com, and use the coupon code LeftIsBest. Well, not this week. Not this week. Starting in November 22, and that was, as you know, 2 days ago, although it is in the future when I'm saying this.
Yes.
All Sabade products will be between, you ready for this? 30 and 60% off. I repete. That is 30 and 60% off. Orders over $100 will receive a free jar of the Sabade gummies. Look at the look on Emma's face right now.
What do you mean?
Well, she's like, I'm going to buy that stuff.
Well, I mean, but you're going to have to buy it. They send some nice stuff.
That is a $40 value. There is no promo code needed. Products are already discounted on the website. 30 to 60% off. This is your time to load up. But here is the best part. I mean, you look, if you haven't heard me talk about Sunset Lake Sebade by now, this is the first time you watch a show. And if that's the case, I will tell you this. The tincture, incredible in terms of helping me sleep. The salve was great. They don't market it this way, but for my eczema, for whatever reason, but it was with Arnica, it's really helpful for sore muscles. They got hand lotion. They have really delicious coffee that is my weekend brew because it, you know, chills me out a little bit, but also gives me my caffeine, which I need. They have gummies, as I mentioned. They have smokables. They have pre-rolls. They have keef. They have fudge. The fudge. All of this now, 30 to 60% off. But here's the deal. Sunset Lake Sebade and this program, the Majority Report, teaming up to turn this incredibly consumerist holiday into an opportunity for a great organization. Here's how it works. You go to Sunset Lake, you buy this stuff, 30 to 60% off. Sunset Lake Sebade is going to donate 10% of its sales to givedirectly.org. It's one of my favorite charities. It is an anti-poverty organization that sends cash directly to people to choose for themselves how to spend the money with dignity that best suits their lives. All the research has shown the best way to help people living in extreme poverty is to give them money. They know what their needs are. And the Majority Report is going to match that 10% donation. So if you buy, not you individually, but I mean, if our audience over the course of this couple of weeks buys $100,000 worth of Sebade, Sunset Lake is going to send 10 grand. We're going to send 10 grand. And meanwhile, Sunset Lake Sebade is a majority employee owned business that I've mentioned before. They have donated more than $16,000 this year to anti-drug war organizations, to animal shelters, to union strike funds, to nature conservation, food shelves, and refugee resettlement organizations. Again, visit sunsetlakesebade.com. Take advantage of these discounts and help the Majority Report raise money for a great organization. The sale ends December 1st. All right. Here's that interview with historian Christopher W. Shaw, author of First Class, The U.S. Postal Service, Democracy, and the Corporate Threat. We may tag something on for members, but probably not. It's Wednesday. You're going to be driving. Have a great, great Thanksgiving, yes, everybody. We will be back Friday with more new programming for you. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Joining me now, historian Christopher Shaw. He is the author of First Class, The U.S. Postal Service, Democracy, and the Corporate Threat. Welcome to back to the program, I should say, Christopher.
Glad to be back. Good to talk to you again.
Okay, let's go. I want to just, you know, go through a little bit of the history of the post office. When was it? 1792 is when the Postal Service, I guess, is established officially. Is that right?
1792 is an important date because that's when the post office really gets going, like you say. But it actually gets started back in 1775. So during the early years of the Revolutionary War, because the Patriots wanted to have their own postal system to communicate with. But 1792 is when it really takes on the duty of transmitting mail. It becomes a major or news. It becomes a major communications network. It decides that that's the most important thing, and it's really a duty to make sure that citizens are informed in this new experiment with Republican government. And so it's going to transmit newspapers all over the country, and it's going to do it at the lowest possible price that it can.
So, I mean, so, okay, so we have this change from when we're talking 1775, it is really almost like a, it is a, it's almost like a military tactic, I guess, in some way, in terms of creating a communication system so that it can't be, so that it's like wholly owned, I guess, by those who are, you know, wanting to avoid the king, as it were. And in 1792, it is the first, I guess, institutional expression of what the post office can be outside of merely communicating troop movements or, you know, just sort of there's a broader set of values, and that is the democratization. How was that articulated? Like, what, how explicit was that?
George Washington was very interested in this, and he thought that the basically a postal system had an important role to play in linking the country together and binding it together, and also in making sure that citizens knew what the federal government was doing and were aware of current events. So he articulated this specifically to Congress. He was very encouraging of making sure there'd be a low postage rate for news, for newspapers, for pamphlets, for periodicals. And that was right part of it from the very start, and Congress agreed and responded, and that's how we get this policy. It's a guiding force in the postal system up to this day, really.
Okay, and so from that, what is the next sort of big, I guess, watershed movement, a moment, I should say, in the development of the Postal Service? And is it, tell us. I mean, is it a legislative thing, or is it really more just sort of the way that it's perceived by our citizenry as, you know, sort of, I guess, customers of the Postal Service?
One important thing about the post office right from the start is that it's really, for many people, the only way they experience the government at all at the very beginning. And it's kind of this commonality that they all have that links everyone together, whether you're in the South or in the Northeast or, you know, in the interior of the country. They're all linked together by the post office. And the post office takes on the obligation to extend the service to new areas so that everyone will be part of this national community linked together through the news and this communications network. And so there was always a debate, like, should it make money? Should it lose money? The idea from the beginning, there was never the idea it should make a profit. And that was actually the way the British colonial postal system worked, is to make profit. So that was never the idea. But then it's sort of officially in 1851, there's a law passed that basically says, the possibility of a deficit should never get in the way of expanding the service. And from that point forward, then there's any concern that a deficit might mean that we shouldn't roll out new services disappears. So that's another really important moment at that point. And so this means then we're going to have stagecoaches carrying mail to California, losing a lot of money, but that's okay because it's important to have this national infrastructure in place.
How was that received? I mean, what was the nature of the debate there? I mean, there was a quote from your book, I think it was from 1894, where and we will get there in terms of like the reduced rate for paperback books. And we were joking about it in the studio, just reading that quote and how much our society feels like it has devolved. But the quote was something to the effect of like, well, it doesn't matter how much it costs because it's really important to get great literature to Americans. You know, I think it was like a congressman had said, and I just think like, oh my God, that just sounds, the idea that that is the perspective in 1894, we're still largely like a rural country, like, you know, and the idea that, you know, there's a concern by our congresspeople about exposure to literature as a positive, as opposed to what we see today, is just sort of fascinating. But what was the, how, like, was that a controversial position in 1854, or maybe things got caught up with the war, you know, at that point where, you know, people aren't thinking about it as much, but I'm curious as to what the disposition towards, like, how much of a value, how much was that value valued?
There was always a controversy. There were always the people who were bean counters, who were worried about postal deficit. But really, the majority in Congress, again and again, says, we don't care if it loses some money because, like you said, The congressman who thought it was important to get good literature to people or to make sure people are informed. And that wins out again and again. And that really reflects the attitude of the American people. Congress is responding to the American people who are saying, we want our mail delivered faster. We want to be able to receive books through the mail, and we want to be able to do that cheaply. We want our newspaper and magazine postage to be low. So again and again, you see Congress responding really to the public demand. And in that way, the post office was really remarkably democratic, and it was kind of the American people who created it through their demands, and Congress who then put those demands into policy and made them real.
It must have been like, I mean, the idea that you could get a letter from Massachusetts to California at that time must have been like it was like magic. I mean, it really must have been just sort of the concept of that someone could send you a message. And like, how long would it take a letter to go from Boston to California, let's say, you know, I don't know, in the mid to late 1800s?
So the Pony Express, which, you know, was this big breakthrough, happens in right before the Civil War, they could get it in a little over a week from Missouri to California. So things are taking a long time, but at the time, this is seen as lightning speed, and it really is a moment of a communications revolution, right? This is a time when you have the telegraph is invented, but alongside it is the postal system, and the speed with which the mail is being delivered is creating a revolution in communication and linking everyone together.
Was there anything like this around the world? I mean, first off, there's very few places. Well, I mean, I guess it would have to have been international. I mean, you know, in Europe to cover that type of ground, or on the continent of Africa, I guess, or, you know, I guess maybe in Russia. But was there anything that was even remotely equivalent in terms of speed and like scope in terms of like where it would go?
I think the ambitions of the American Post Office are really great. And you can see that reflected in the fact that there were more newspapers that were circulating in the United States in the 19th century than any other country. And that has everything to do with the postal system that could support that kind of distribution. So this ambition that this, you know, very large country that spans a continent is going to have a postal system where everyone's going to get their mail really is, it was really something at the time. And it was really actually a big source of pride amongst Americans at the time that our post office is really good.
Was there anything that came close? I mean, like, what kind of postal service did you have in Europe? Did you have in Russia?
There were good postal systems in Britain was a, you know, important postal system, but then it's also like so much smaller. And that's the thing about it. And then just the kind of access that an average citizen had after they start cutting postage rates in the, you know, 1840s and 1850s, and just that kind of access, I don't think was anything that the Tsar in Russia was particularly interested in, you know, providing to his subjects. And that's just that different attitude that there was in the United States, where these are our citizens and they all need to be able to participate in this postal system and be connected to the government and to each other and to know what's going on.
Okay. So the next, if I'm not mistaken, the next sort of, I guess, a watershed, at least in terms of like legislative action with the post office is in 1879. The Postal Act of 1879. Is that right?
Well, what you see time and again is the post office, it keeps reducing rates and it keeps making it more affordable to mail things. And then to include like periodicals, then they get their postage rate dropped down to what it had been for newspapers. And so there's just a series of acts where this happens throughout the late 19th century that just make it again more accessible to the average person to mail letters, to receive newspapers, to use the post office.
Is that a function of, again, is like, I mean, this is what's just so, I guess I'm trying to find out like when we went off the rails a little bit. And, but was that a function because there was, I don't know, big newspaper was lobbying for this? I mean, was there lobbying to sort of, you know, I guess, develop a newspaper industry or a book industry, on the back, as it were, a little bit of taxpayer money with the post office? Or was it a combination of economic interests and sort of like broadly an understanding of like, we want to educate people. I mean, 1879, we are, we're in the midst of Reconstruction, and there's a, there seems to be a, just a broad awareness that like, we want to educate people. I mean, this is when we get public education is becomes sort of widely, instituted. So what else is happening? I mean, what are the forces that are making, that are expanding the rate drop, if you will, and the sort of the gist of what is being mailed?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's kind of like you laid out. So there are definitely all these newspaper editors, and they have an interest in making sure that the postage rates are low. There are, you know, other groups that want to mail things through the post office that they're interested in it. So there are those kind of targeted lobbyists, but there really is a lot of civic engagement in postal questions at the time. And so, for instance, one big thing that happens is in the 1890s, you begin to get an experiment in rural free delivery, RFD. And so this is the idea that the post office will actually deliver mail to your house if you live in a rural area. And at that time, most Americans, they live in the countryside. And so this is really a revolutionary development. It's very expensive. It finally becomes a permanent service right at the beginning of the 20th century. But the reason this happens is that all of these, you know, constituents are petitioning Congress, they're mailing letters asking for this service. So there was this constant really demand of the kind of the average citizen that we want our post office to provide better service to us, to service even more than it already is. So it's, there's a combination where you do have this kind of specific special interests, like, you know, newspaper publishers, but you also do have a real citizen interest in this. And then I think you're right. There is an attitude that this is a democracy and people need to know what's going on and people are entitled to this as well amongst a lot of politicians.
Was that moment the moment of like, what were the moments of the greatest expansion? Because I imagine if you're going to do rural free delivery at that point, you're going to need to beef up those sort of hubs of postal, both hubs and then sort of satellite post offices. And then from there, people are being sent out from there. I mean, I would imagine that that becomes a big expansion of the system.
Yeah, I mean, the post office is, it's a huge bureaucracy, so to speak, at that time, in a time when the federal government really doesn't do a whole lot in like the, you know, the turn of the 20th century. You know, the United States kind of has a very even small, like, standing army. I mean, we don't really even get a big, you know, standing army until after World War II. And that's why you get Eisenhower warning about the military industrial complex. So what the federal government is known for to people at that time, and what it really does is it delivers the mail. And so, yeah, it grew leaps and bounds at that time. New post offices are built, new employees are hired. Railroad cars are, you know, put on the railroads to sort mail. So it's a big enterprise. It really is.
So when does the impetus to privatize and to corporatize the post office start to kick in?
Yeah. So one big moment is in 1971, the post office department, which had been a cabinet level department with the postmaster general being a member of the president's cabinet, and, you know, specifically a government service and was also received some taxpayer subsidy, it get turned into the United States Postal Service that we have today. And the United States Postal Service is self-funding through the sale of postage. And it also is removed a step from politics, where Congress has some oversight, but now the Postmaster General is no longer a presidential appointee. You have a board of governors that are presidential appointees, and they select the Postmaster General. So at this moment, there is the idea that, okay, this thing is going to be fully self-funded. And then it really picks off from there, where in the 1970s, you have this right-wing movement getting funded, starting up these think tanks.
Well, let me, before we go further from that moment, I just want to go back. Like, what was the impetus for that? Because at this point, by the time we get to 1970, right, the post office becomes not only sort of ubiquitous in terms of the way that people get their mail and whatnot, and the way that we communicate and through the 50s and the 60s has to be sort of like the peak of like catalog shopping, as it were. And also, I would also imagine it has become a crucial source of providing solid middle-class jobs for like a huge swath of Americans, right? I mean, so what what was going on during that, and we should say this is happening during Nixon. What was going on during that period that set off the alarm bells for the corporatizers and the privatizers that they wanted to sort of like decouple this from its relationship with our, at least our legislative process?
So there's a moment in 1966 when the big post office in Chicago, which is a huge facility, there's like literally an interstate running through it, through that building, it grinds to a halt. And it has to do with the fact that there really hadn't been a lot of investment in the sorting infrastructure and the processing infrastructure in the 1950s and the 1960s, at the same time that the kind of physical, logistical transportation layout of the country changed a lot, because we changed from a country where it's very much revolving around the railroad to one that's the interstate highway. And so there's a lot of issues here that just you weren't getting the investment and you weren't getting adapted to this new, more suburban nation in terms of mail processing and transportation. So when the mail grinds to a halt in the Chicago, the main Chicago post office at that time, then this is taken as an excuse by a lot of really corporate interests who get together a lobbying campaign and they start saying, look, this is a government service. It can't possibly be efficient. It would be much better if we make it run more like a business. And that's how they get it through. And the one thing is also is postal workers at that time, they hadn't gotten a raise in a long time. Some of them were, you know, dependent on food stamps, welfare benefits and such. A lot of them were working more than one job. And so in order to get them on board, then they offer them a much needed raise at the same time. So these are the kinds of things that, that lead to the reorganization into the U.S. Postal Service.
What was the designs like? What were those corporate lobbyists? What were they hoping? Like, what was their agenda in this regard to private, you know, to privatize it? And it, was it simply ideological, or was there a were there people out there going like, maybe we can set up something like FedEx or UPS, or what was the designs of those people? And then let's move into the 70s as it starts to take hold.
I think that for there definitely was an ideological motivation there, no two ways about it. And I think there was also for some of these companies specifically who, you know, spent a lot of money on postage, the idea that this would give them better access and sort of more determining over how the postal system worked than under the old system under Congress, where also you have, you know, hearing from citizens and these other people. And then in general, just the idea that if this is run in a more business-like manner, then it's going to prioritize its big customers, right? So if I'm a, you know, a corporation that sends out a million letters, you know, every month, then I'm going to start to get better treatment instead of, you know, the kind of traditional policy, which is any American can go and buy a postage stamp and gets the same treatment, right? It's very democratic in that way. So I think these are the kinds of ideas that were circulating at that time and motivating this move.
It's taken 50 years, maybe, but I mean, that's happened. On some level, right? I mean, it's the big corporate interests who are relying on the post office to essentially subsidize part of their business have succeeded. So walk us through how that happens there.
Well, so the, you know, the idea of the postal system, postal service is going to be more business-like. And so if it's already then, okay, it's going to be self-funded by postage, operate more like a business. Then in the 1970s, with this big pushback against the New Deal and what led to, you know, the Reagan Revolution, you get all this money going into these think tanks in Washington, D.C., like the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute, and they all jump on board the idea of, okay, let's just take this even a step further. Let's just privatize it entirely and deregulate the postal market to run it just like a business. That would really be the most efficient, best way to do it. And so literally decades, they're putting out books, reports, columns, testifying to Congress that this would be a good idea, and this ongoing drumbeat for this. And the thing about it is, of course, you know, the Postal Service is a big prize if your agenda is privatization, because it's one of the nation's largest employers. And it's also a government service that touches all of our lives, you know, 6 days a week. Like, we all have it in our neighborhoods, in our communities. We all use it. And so if your agenda is also to like squeeze government out of the lives of Americans, to not have government be something that they think can make their life better or even do anything in their lives at all, then, you know, yeah, get rid of the post office, because that's the way that we're all dealing with the government all the time. And that we see that it actually literally delivers for us, right? I mean, you know, the government delivers in ways, Social Security, I mean, you know, these kinds of programs, but here it's actually delivering the mail to our to our homes, right? I mean, there's a federal employee that comes and does that. So it's really been kind of high on the agenda of these right-wing interest groups for decades, and just an ongoing push in this direction.
So at what point did they realize, I mean, you know, because I the post office for me is, you know, it's like Social Security and post office for me are sort of like the peak examples of a government that is functioning well. And one of the things that I think the right has done over the years at different times is attempt to inhibit the functioning of Social Security, because you can't really argue to Americans that they don't want Social Security, because it's been wildly successful. It's hugely popular. So the only way you can do that is to sort of quietly undermine its operations. We're going to cut back on Social Security staff. We're going to maybe cut down, you know, under right-wing administrations, we can cut down the number of offices. We can make it harder for people to access their Social Security and get a wedge in between their Americans' relationship with Social Security. And it feels like at one point, and it culminates in my estimation around 2006, but it feels like there is a similar strategy by the right. Like, we cannot, it's hard to convince people that there's something wrong with the post office, because every day they're like, oh my God, here's a letter. It costs 25 cents to, or, you know, now 40 some odd, but to get this letter. Was there a sort of a way to mark when the strategy was introduced? Like, maybe we can undercut the quality of the service, and then we have another sort of, you know, like we did with Chicago, another opportunity to argue for privatization.
Yeah. So, George W. Bush administration is kind of important here, because they get together a commission, a presidential commission, by the way, on the Postal Service. And it essentially really recommends that further steps towards privatization. Also, let's really start cutting things here. We should consider maybe only delivering, you know, less days a week. We should consider slowing down the mail. We aren't going to necessarily recommend this, because we know people won't want it, but it's something we want to put on the table. You know, we should consider closing a lot of post offices. And so these kind of proposals are put in place as a way that, well, it can be more efficient. We'll modernize it for the 21st century, because there's this new thing called the internet, so we wouldn't possibly need to actually deliver items anymore. And then what happens is the 2006 Act goes through, and it includes this requirement for the Postal Service to pre-fund its healthcare benefits for its retirees, literally like 75 years in advance. And the thing is that the way that all the other government agencies work and the way that private corporations work is much closer to a pay-as-you-go model. So maybe we're funding
There's no other entity on the planet Earth that is required or decides to pre-fund their retirement plans for people who are not even born yet. Yeah. Right? I mean, people aren't working at the post office till they're 75. So you are requiring the fully funding of the benefits for people who aren't even alive yet, never mind not working at the post office yet. It's stunning that, but now I once asked the head of the Postal Service Union, we had an odd exchange about it, because from my perspective, it was certainly a proposal that was pushed by the Bush administration. It was adopted by Congress. I can't remember exactly if the Democrats controlled Congress at that time, but there was a question of like it being somewhat bipartisan at that time. Is that your understanding of it? I mean, or was it, was that indicative of the Democrats at that time being, you know, which is not to say that they're not now, but really enthralled in a sort of neoliberal privatized scheme? I mean, we should say Rahm Emanuel was, in Congress at that time and this is a guy who also privatized parking meters in Chicago. So he's certainly inclined to do this type of thing.
Yeah. What I would say, what it really came from is the fact that the Postal Service had basically done a big overpayment into its retirement accounts. And so that's a separate pool of money from the Postal Service. So for the U.S. Treasury to then return that money, it would have increased the federal budget deficit. And so the controller at that time, Walker, was very concerned about increasing the federal budget deficit. And so at the time also, there were, you know, definitely were Democrats who were talking more about the federal budget deficit back then than now. And so it was kind of put in the bill and people didn't recognize what a problem would be, because at that time, the Postal Service was doing pretty well financially. But then 2008 hits, you get the financial crisis. Every time the economy suffers, then postal revenues go down. And so then at that point, this really became a major burden. And it's basically operated as like this paper loss, right? Like the Postal Service's cash flow has actually been pretty decent, more or less around break even. But then it has this $5.5 billion it's supposed to be, you know, paying into this, you know, paying every year. And so that's where then it really looks like it's in financial crisis, even though the income coming in is would not reflect that.
That's fascinating. So this was sort of like the classic lockbox thing that Al Gore was talking about in the context of Social Security, which is the U.S. government has basically been borrowing. Essentially, it was borrowing from the post office. It didn't want to return the money back. And therefore it said, you got to put more money in so that we can expend the money that you've put in already. And we will then pay your retirees with money that is supposedly for retirees 30 or 40 years out from now.
Yeah. The money went into an escrow account and, you know, and then this pre-funding requirement, burden was put on the Postal Service. And it's really, it's the cause of all this talk of financial problems.
Like so the post office is operating more or less pay as you go with the stamps, except for this bizarre requirement that is really a function of politicians not wanting to acknowledge that they have borrowed money from the post office. They don't want to pay it back. That's basically what it comes down to. So let's go up to the Trump administration. As you were talking about the Bush administration, all of those sort of principles, you could have been talking about the Trump administration too. When you talk about reducing the number of days, reducing the number of post offices, reducing maybe certain deliveries in certain places. And meanwhile, we have sort of like a growing, you know, a burgeoning private delivery business, but they use the post office infrastructure quite a bit on some level, at least. FedEx does not want to deliver a letter to, you know, central, I don't know, North Dakota, frankly, and they're certainly not going to do it for 40 cents. So what's the story with Louis DeJoy? Like, what was the idea of bringing him in to do this? I mean, it reeks of privatization. But B, why is he still there?
Yeah, well, first of all, you're absolutely right that we have a government service to deliver mail into central North Dakota because no private business wants to do it, right? So a lot of people would just be disenfranchised if we were to try to turn this over to a private company. But in terms then of like Louis DeJoy, you know, his background is in the trucking business. He's made a lot of money in trucking. And then his other background is as a Republican Party fundraiser. I mean, he was the finance chair of the Republican National Convention. He gave over $1 million to Trump. So he had the right connections. And the thing is, when his name came up for Postmaster General, you actually had a couple members of the Board of Governors resign because they didn't think he was qualified at all. And then he came in. We saw what happened back in August 2020 with, we're going to suddenly disrupt the entire postal system when we are depending on it most to even vote in the national election here. And at that point, then we got some pushback that was stopped. We can be thankful the post office helped us to hold a national election at all. But then the question remains, why is he still there? And the answer is that he serves at the discretion of the Postal Board of Governors. And there were 6 members that Trump appointed, and they are still there. And Biden appointed 3 new members, but the majority of the Trump appointees who picked him in the first place and have supported his policies, they're still serving, they're still in place. And until they just, you know, there's a change, we decide we want to change, then he will be there. Now, there are 2 openings coming up in December. 2 of the Trump appointees, their terms will expire. So if Biden picks 2 new people, then we could get a changing perspective, perhaps on the Board of Governors, and they may decide that they want a new Postmaster General.
So it would be instead of 6-3, it would be 5. instead of 6-3, it would be 4-5. I mean, if two new comes up, that would leave the Trump people with four and the Biden appointed people at five. Is that right?
Yeah, they'd have a majority at that point. Yeah.
Is there no way that Biden could have expedited this? Like, couldn't he have fired some governors, or no? Or would that have been sort of like, I don't know, extra administrative or something?
It would have been definitely unprecedented. And I don't know that there's the legal authority to have taken that kind of a step. Because they haven't shown, you'd have to sort of show that they've been like grossly negligent, which maybe you can make a case for, but I think it was seen as a legal problem.
If they figure they can do this by December or, you know, beginning of 2022, maybe that's their thinking there. But so let's turn to, what was DeJoy's agenda? Was he simply like a good-natured guy who's like, oh, I come from the trucking and logistics business and this is how we would do it? You know, job number one is profit. And or is he going in there going like, well, I also have, I have friends who are in the logistics business. And, you know, if the post office isn't doing X, Y, or Z, then maybe they're going to make a little bit more money. And by a little bit more money, I mean a ton more money. Is that what, like, do we have a sense of that? Is there any way to know? I mean, the impact's the same, it seems to me, but there's no way to know. And if the post office is making money, except for that one absurd, requirement, none of this is really necessary, is it? Particularly if you perceive it as a service as opposed to a money-making center.
Well, one thing that's never made sense is it's always been this big push to close like small rural post offices. And the expense to operate these is like tiny. It's like this little drop in the bucket. And so it really is just about a sort of misapprehension of the idea that, okay, yeah, at a business, we do it this way, but it's a public service.
It's also another method of decoupling rural voters' appreciation of the post office, which is, you know, the voting cohort that you would start with if you were a Republican in terms of who you want to be in favor of getting rid of privatizing the post office.
Yeah, I mean, ever since RFD, there really has been a high estimation of the post office in rural America. I mean, it really has been. That's where it's very popular. And so I think you make a very good point there about what the political ramifications of these kinds of changes are.
Let's talk about the postal banking, that experiment that has gone on. And I had David Dayan on, who is, you know, I don't know, he's probably number one fan of postal banking in the country. I may be number two. That's probably an exaggeration. There are other people who have dedicated themselves. I would include you probably in that.
Thank you.
Nevertheless, for lay people, let's put it this way. They did four cities, experiment in four cities with postal banking. As of like the other day, nobody had taken advantage of it in the Bronx, where they had set it up. From what I've read, there was a very unimpressive effort by the Postal Service to advertise, to market, to even let the postal workers who were dealing with this know more than a week or two in advance that this was happening. It feels to me, and I want to hear your assessment, that Louis DeJoy knows that there's two new governors coming in December, January, February. He either A, wants to make it look like he's open to some of the progressive initiatives that people want, or B, he wants to provide fodder for those people who think these initiatives can't work. And so if he's, you know, if I'm going to run an experiment and I want that experiment to fail, I would rather run it than allow the next person to run it.
Yeah, no, David Dayan's report has pointed out some real shortcomings here with it. And I think the thing is, it's very out of character for Louis DeJoy to support this idea in the first place, right? And he has a lot of political opposition because of everything he's done. And so, you know, he does this and people, well, maybe look at it a little differently. And then also the American Postal Workers Union, this has been a major point that they've been really wanting to get this service up and running. And so, you know, he's kind of making some friends a little bit maybe by doing this. But one thing I'll say about the lack of publicity is this was a constant issue with the Postal Savings Bank back when we had it in the 20th century. where again and again, the post office was prevented from providing the kind of publicity that such a service would need. And it still did very well despite that, because there's a real demand out there. But I'm just saying that this is like, you know, this is an old trick here to not publicize the service. And to a certain extent, you know, it's they don't want to run afoul of the check cashing business and the banking industry and their lobby and such. So that's probably part of it too, you know, but definitely it's ridiculous that you're not actually getting publicity so people know the service is available. If you actually want us to succeed.
What's your sense of where we go from here with the post office? And you know, like there's this assumption that people have that like, oh, email and, you know, DHL and FedEx and US and UPS, you know, the post office is not doing well, which you've shown that be essentially a myth. But in the future, I mean, short of like teleportation coming up, like what do you see both the political and the sort of the functional future of the post office?
Well, I think that there is electronic diversion happening, right? And so I do think there are sort of longer term revenue issues here that we're going to have to resolve. But at the same time, though, we also have that value counterbalance by the fact that people are getting so many more packages shipped to them. So we don't exactly know where the revenue is going to fall out. You know, we can't tell that right now. But I think we all do want a healthy, vibrant postal service so that when a national emergency arrives like COVID and we need to vote, then we can do it. So I think that there should really be a serious discussion here about what the Postal Service needs to do going forward. And I think this also involves bringing it up to date. I mean, in the late 19th century, the post office, until RFD, it wasn't delivering mail in rural areas. The post office didn't actually deliver packages until the early 20th century. And that's because there was a handful of private companies that basically price gouged and ripped people off. So again, people lobbied to get parcel posts, to get the post office delivering packages. And so I think we're at another moment here where we need to think about updating the post office for this new age. I think that includes postal banking. I think that probably involves looking at maybe some electronic communication services and other things like that as well. But I guess the thing is that really the post office was created by the lobbying of the American people saying what they wanted and then pushing to make that happen. And I think that that is what we need to have again at this moment. And I am honestly encouraged by the interest that we saw in 2020, this new interest in the Postal Service and a new engagement with it. I think that's a good sign going forward. And it also is an issue where it's not completely partisan. There are Republicans who represent rural districts and rural states who understand that they need the Postal Service there for their constituents too. So I think there is some hope here, you know, for this issue going forward.
You mentioned electronic services. Let me ask you a two-part question that isn't related, but it reminds me of. Is one, what are those electronic services that you envision that the post office could serve? I mean, the postal banking, I think, would be huge and even broader than the limited experiment that we're seeing in terms of, like, you know, just check cashing stuff. But since you said electronic, it reminded me of a story that there was the post office has a police department or has a you know, like a postal police, which I've always perceived as like, okay, well, if someone's mailing stuff through the post office, they shouldn't be doing, or maybe they help out with, you know, more traditional law enforcement if there is crimes that you know, are implicated by statutes in using wire fraud and mail fraud. But they have been monitoring social media. Why?
Yeah, no, it's kind of a, like, things have gotten a little rogue there in the last year or so when this first came out. Because you're right. I mean, there's postal property, you know, thousands of post offices, there's postal workers, there's mail fraud that occurs. There are reasons to have this kind of police force, but they've been working, I guess, with other federal agencies. And yeah, I think there should be more digging into why they're doing this.
Do you have any idea? I mean, because it sounds to me like one of those sort of classic situations where traditional law enforcement is constrained by statute as to what they can legally do, but they use the Postal Service as sort of like an outsource to, you know, skirt around maybe some type of, restrictions on their behavior.
No, it's possible that there's less, frankly, attention paid to the postal police. I mean, it's possible that could be the case. I think the way they describe it is basically they're sort of working in conjunction with other federal law enforcement agencies. But again, it's worrisome. It is. And the irony is, though, is there's some legal scholars who have pointed to the fact that there is a privacy protection in the U.S. mail that doesn't exist in internet communications. And of course, a lot of these tech companies, their business is based on surveilling their users and then advertising to them. And what they've suggested is the Postal Service could actually provide these kinds of electronic communications, email, maybe even search engine services that would then be protected from, you know, they'd have these privacy protections in place. So, you know, that's the kind of direction that legally seems to be possible that the Postal Service could be headed. But then, as you're pointing out, we're having this situation with the police doing something that looks pretty different. So. You know, I think it'd be good to shine a light on all this.
That's fascinating. If I wanted to not be the product and use a free or, you know, minimally expensive service, the post office provides me with the type of privacy protections that I can probably get nowhere else.
I think it seems like that is, you know, definitely possible because that is, you know, that first class postage stamp, once you put it on an envelope, that is sealed. It cannot be, you know, tampered with. It cannot be looked at. I mean, there's a lot of protections there in a way that there just isn't for a lot of the other ways we communicate these days.
Christopher W. Shaw, the book is First Class, the U.S. Postal Service, Democracy, and the Corporate Threat. Thank you so much for your time today. Really, I can't tell you how much I enjoy talking about the post office and the postal service. Thanks so much.
Great talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.